Thank you, everybody. I think we can proceed on with the agenda, and we'll start with Rachel, who's going to talk to us about the measurement.
Thank you, Ian. We'd like to talk for about the next 40, 45 minutes on measurement. So that's section 6 in the discussion paper. Agenda paper 1 sets out the questions that we'd like to discuss with you during that sort of 40, 45 minutes. And we start off with the objective of measurement, and that's set out in paragraphs 2 to 4 of the agenda paper. What we're doing is we're proposing a measurement objective within the conceptual framework, and that measurement objective is set out in paragraph 4. It's very closely linked to the overall objective of financial reporting in chapter 1 of the conceptual framework, in that it refers to information that is needed provide information about the resources of the entity, claims against the entity, changes in resources and claims, and information about how efficiently and effectively the entity's management have used those resources. And those all link very closely to the overall objective of financial reporting. It also makes reference to the qualitative characteristics of use for financial information, in that we say that measurement should provide relevant information, and the information should provide a faithful representation of the resources and claims, etc. The questions we'd like you to address are set out below paragraph 4, and basically we would like to know whether you think the framework should include an overall measurement objective, and if so, why or why not, and then whether you actually agree with the measurement objective that is suggested in the conceptual framework paper, and if you disagree with that objective, what changes you would like to see made to it. So with that, I'd like to open it up for discussion and comment.
If you'd like to speak, just put your flag up. Anybody got any comments on that to begin?
Overall, do you think it's useful to have a measurement objective?
I think that the issue with the measurement objective is it's kind of very general. To be honest, my reaction was, why bother with it if it's so general? It's not going to achieve anything useful for you, so either decide on a more concrete one that will lead to something useful, or don't worry about having an objective for measurement in those terms.
Richard?
I agree with that. It is quite general, so there's nothing... So in principle, there's nothing wrong with including it. Just a couple of detailed things I might ask about, if I may, is the phrase "how efficiently and effectively the entity's management discharge their responsibility" is that your definition of financial performance? As a matter of interest, but perhaps we're coming to that that later. The other one was, is the ISB now? We've noticed this with other people. Management and governing board. Are we making some, up to now, as far as I'm aware, ISB, IFRS talk about management of the company. Is ISB now moving into a sort of, where you're distinguishing different groups within management? Sorry, those two were perhaps rather small points.
Take the first one first.
Yeah, the first one first, about the effectively and efficiently management and the governing board have discharged their responsibilities. That's really intended to get at what a lot of people call stewardship. It's taken directly from the objective of financial reporting in Chapter 1.
This is not new. None of these words are new.
What it's trying to get at is provide through the measurement, providing information that would be useful to assess the stewardship of management. As I said, that comes directly from Chapter 1. Similarly, the wording about management and governing body, that comes from Chapter 1 of the overall objective of financial reporting. And I don't think there was any intention to sort of separate the two. What we're just trying to talk about is the overall management of the entity. So nothing special intended by those words.
I think it's done for completeness so that people don't say, oh, it's just the executive management.
Right, okay. Okay.
But again, it, just to emphasise, that's straight out of chapter one, the
that's
existing
straight out
chapter,
chapter one.
One.
Right, okay.
Which we haven't fiddled with so far.
So far.
But you want us to take it out?
No particular problem with my emphasis.
Jed.
Yeah, I think as you're clearly heading down a mixed measurement model, I think it would be quite useful in this the measurement objective to describe the attributes of why you're going to head in that direction and what the objectives are. And talking about stewardship, the way I always think about the way managements discharge their obligations is I actually divide them up into two categories. They're either operational stewardship or financial stewardship. And I think you measure performance or stewardship in different ways depending on those things. So operationally it's around how effectively they're, you know, spending their money on capital equipment to increase their capacity to make more of whatever it is they do, or to hire more people to generate more outputs, or whatever those are. They tend to be sort of very flows based, cost based in financial reporting jargon. And then from a financial stewardship perspective, actually, things like how you're managing your asset liability matching in your defined benefit pension plan, that's actually more a current value measure of performance and stewardship. And you know, I think it would be useful when you're defining your measurement objective to make it clear how you're thinking about stewardship and performance as early as possible.
I think that's quite an interesting point, actually, and that actually touches on something that I think is in the objective itself that hasn't necessarily been visible to people in the past. And that's the reference to information about the resources and claims and the changes in claims. Because in the past, people have often said, oh, it's a balance sheet approach. You're only interested in when you recognise assets and liabilities and how to measurement. You're not interested in the P&L. It's just a byproduct of measurement. And I think what we were trying to do here was give a clear signal that in selecting measurements, the board ought to be looking at what kind of information it produces in the balance sheet and in the P&L. And obviously we'd elaborate a bit on that in the discussion further on in the discussion paper, but we wanted to keep the objective itself fairly crisp.
Yeah, I mean, were you suggesting, Jed, that I'm wondering whether you're suggesting we expand the objective or whether we kind of build explanation around it. You know, the 2 points, one on why we're going to a mixed measurement model and, you know, the split of stewardship.
I think the earlier you create within the framework where you're heading towards, the better. And so I'd probably think about changing the objective.
Right. Yes, Brenda.
I think it's quite difficult to think about measurement in isolation from recognition. So it does seem that the framework isn't going to have a filter for probability, say. So measurement is going to be much more important than it has been. So it's quite difficult to address that on its own.
Would you like to see, how would you see that affecting the actual objective?
I think just to view everything together, so probably to work from the definitions through recognition and then to measurement.
Okay. Any further comments on this first part? It's all been helpful, thank you.
In which case, if we could move on to the next part, which talks about the number of measurement bases that the board should use. Of course, there's a lot of debate about whether we should actually use a single measurement basis, or at the very least in the conceptual framework have an objective of a single measurement basis. But what we do in the discussion paper is suggest that a single measurement basis, for example, everything at fair value or everything at cost, would be unlikely to provide the most relevant information, that selecting different types of measurement bases would allow us to produce more relevant information. And so the preliminary view of the board is that we wouldn't recommend measuring all assets and liabilities on the same basis. We go on in paragraph 9 to talk about the number of different measurements used, and we suggest that although we're not saying we should use a single measurement basis, we should actually limit the number of measurement bases used to the smallest number necessary to provide relevant information. I think it's worth adding to this that we're not trying to impose an artificial restriction here on the number of measurement bases that are actually going to be used. What we're saying is that the board needs to be aware that when they design a new measurement basis, for example, a new cash flow based measurement, it requires quite a bit of work on the part of preparers and users to understand that new measurement basis. So designing new measurement bases every time we have a new standard is perhaps not the best way forward. It might reduce the understandability of financial statements. So we should think seriously about whether we can use one of the more standard measurements rather than designing new measurements every time we introduce a standard. So that's behind that sort of preliminary view that the number of measurement bases should be the smallest necessary to provide relevant information. With that brief explanation, I'd like to hand it over to you to discuss the questions below paragraph 9, which is, firstly, do you agree that a single measurement basis is not the right way to go, that we should use more than one measurement basis? And then secondly, do you agree with the idea that we should, in the interest of understandability, restrict the number of measurement bases to the smallest number necessary to provide relevant information?
Thank you. I think it's a no-brainer, the discussion of one measurement basis or more measurement basis. All things at cost that is not useful for users, and all things on fair value, that's the same story. So we agree with the idea that there should be more than one measurement basis. In view of the question, should we limit the number of measurement bases? I think a limitation in measurement bases is an advantage to users because of what you say, the understandability of the financial statements will, I think, decrease if there will be too many measurement bases, and if you create every time a measurement base, it's better to see if you can use the measurement bases that are already there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks. I agree that we wouldn't measure everything on the same basis. I got kind of a question though around what we mean by the smallest number necessary. I think the way that it's presented in the document is that there's essentially three different ways of measuring it, measuring assets and liabilities, so cost, fair value, and then other cash flow based measurements. I think that kind of that other cash flow based measurements isn't really a single one, and maybe being more explicit about it is a number of different ways of measuring things. So provisions in IAS 37 are different from pensions in IAS 19, which are different from how you'd measure an impaired asset under value in use using three discount rates and just those three in those three examples. So I don't disagree with the smallest number necessary is the way forward, but being clear that when we say three, we actually don't mean three, we mean two, and then three A, B, C, D.
I think that's a really good point to make, actually, because I think when we were talking about restricting to the smallest number necessary, it really is aimed at that third category of cash flow-based measurements, where there are a multitude of different measurements in there that we could potentially go for. But as I say, we should probably restrict the number of those that we actually use and be very sure that if we do design a new one of those, those type of cash flow based measurements, it is justified by the particular circumstances we're looking at.
I mean, another part that interests me is I don't think fair value is the only form of current value either. So within current values you've got a mixture as well as the cash flow ones, so you've probably got a few targets there as you go through. Any further comments on that?
Sorry, just one final.
Welcome, by the way. You missed.
Yeah, sorry to arrive slightly late. probably have come from the closest as well, which is
that's what
we
think.
Literally down the road. So my apologies. I think the option of page 6 of the document, which is using one measure as a for the primary financial statements and then another in the notes. I think in a way that goes back to what we talked about with stewardship, in the sense that the second measure can be to provide that context and understanding of the management stewardship, where another measure might give that sort of secondary understanding for shareholders in terms of how management have exercised that.
Actually, I think it can give quite a lot of different messages, yeah, depending on what the...
Does anybody want to speak out in favour of a single measurement basis?
We'll try again this afternoon.
You already find somebody.
It's extremely rare we have complete agreement on something.
Okay.
Is there any further on?
Does that, on the limiting, I mean, I agree, let's not invent, I mean, I agree with many of the comments we've had, let's not invent any new ones unnecessarily, and obviously not, and that actually some of these, there are variations within them. I mean, where does that leave other forms of measurement that we've got in there, like the equity method?
Yeah.
We deliberately didn't address the equity method within the conceptual framework, simply because we wanted to leave it to a standards level project. I think there are lots of questions about what exactly the equity method is. Is it a sort of reduced consolidation, or is it a measurement method? And we didn't particularly want to get bogged down in those questions at this stage, given that we might want to think about it in a standards level project in the future.
Well, it's a hybrid, really, isn't it? And
yeah.
I could find it difficult to justify it conceptually.
Right, but it seems to have been justified pragmatically. That's also so. I mean, if there's no if it lacks a sort of hook in the conceptual framework, is that really its death sentence? It's not going to be able to. It's not going to be able to continue.
Yeah, that's a good point. What do we do with the framework? I think we get into that a little later, but my personal view, and I mean, we've got a lot of process to go through yet before we get to firm views. I don't think we should, once we've finished this framework, say, well, that's it, set in stone, and sweep all the standards and sweep out everything that doesn't comply strictly with it, I think this is an ongoing living document, and I think in the document, in this discussion paper, we say something, if we do something that doesn't fit in with the framework, we should say so and say why, rather than we shouldn't ever do anything that doesn't fit in with the framework.
Right. Yep.
And just to follow up on that, I think we felt that for the equity method, and it goes to a couple of other things as well, which I'll mention in a minute. If we wanted to look at them, we'd want to look at them really in the context of a standards level project anyway. So there didn't seem any particular advantage in trying to bite off part of it first in the framework. We'd probably end up just duplicating the work. That also goes for foreign currency and also for current costs and inflation type issues. Each of those are ones we thought that if we wanted to look at them, it would be better done in the context of standards level projects, and it would just be... adding a distraction, really, for the work on the framework if we try to do it at this stage as well.
Okay. Yes.
Just following up on this point, in that case, wouldn't be maybe necessary to indicate that there might be other measurement, other types of measurement. And also I'm thinking about, even if we agree that I think it would be a good idea to have the smallest number, in the same time, we should think about the fact that when we are going through the standard, the valuation might vary depending on the what we are taking into account, so it opens quite a lot of possibility. I don't know if there is any thought about somehow trying to limit that as well.
So I wasn't quite sure what your second point was.
Well, the second point is that I agree that it's better to limit the number of measurement, because otherwise we it's just too much open and we are losing comparability. Is there any thought to go a bit further and to say something about valuation? I know it's maybe not. In general, we are talking about that in the specific standards, but it's just a question.
You mean sort of detailed mechanics of valuation?
Not really about the mechanics, but to link a bit with the measurement, just to be sure that we limit the number of measurements, because otherwise, through the valuation, we can go more direction.
Okay, John.
Thank you. You just referred to the possibility of the IASB to decide to deviate from the framework, conceptual framework, in drafting a standard. We were wondering what this would mean for preparers if they have to apply IAS 8 paragraph 10-11 when they have to design a accounting policy, because then there is a reference made to the framework, and when the ISB has the possibility in the framework to deviate, do preparers have the same possibility? We, as enforcers, we are not very we do not think that's a good idea, but that's one of the risks we see in this specific provision.
It's the same as the situation at prison. We don't specifically say that we have to say we've deviated from the framework, but we have,
yes,
in the past. And this is saying, well, you can continue to do that, I think, but if you do so, you should explain that you have done so and why. And then I think more directly to your question, the standards override the framework, really, in the hierarchy. So if the standard says that's the way you do it.
Yes, but when the standard is, when there is no standard for your transaction.
Our intention, I think, was that in a situation where there is no standard and you as a preparer are looking to design an accounting policy, we would expect the preparer to actually follow the framework. We wouldn't expect them to try and override the framework in the way that we think the board should have the ability to do. And we perhaps didn't make that quite as clear in the document as we should have done, but our intention would be preparers should follow the framework.
I didn't get it quite at the beginning, but now I understand. When did you then?
I think it's probably covered my point, actually, but it was the same thing. It seems that if something is falling outside the framework, the rules can be different to those existing standards. So it's probably more to do with recognition than measurement. Just also to understand perhaps how existing standards would fit with the framework, where they contradict.
Well, I think that was a point I made earlier, that we haven't made a decision yet, so this is my personal opinion. But I personally wouldn't be in favour of immediately sweeping all the standards and saying change this, change that, change the other. I think this is an evolving situation. Well, Peter mentioned foreign currency. I don't see that when we finish the framework, we're going to turn around immediately and have to look at foreign currency translation. For a start, I don't think everybody wants all their standards turned over overnight.
No, I agree.
But also there's the regular agenda consultation. I mean, the next one is planned for 2015. And so if there are any conflicts between the revised framework and the existing standards, that'll be one of the inputs to the next agenda consultation, and it will need to be considered with all the other inputs to decide what the best priorities are.
Okay. Any further points? Good, Rachel.
Thank you. Having decided on the guidance around the number of measurement bases, the discussion paper then goes on to talk about what the board should consider when selecting a particular measurement. And what we do in here is suggest that the board should focus on how investors and creditors and lenders are likely to assess how assets or liabilities of that type will contribute to future cash flows. And as a consequence of that, the ISB's preliminary view is that a selection of a measurement for a particular asset should depend on how it contributes to future cash flows, and for a particular liability should depend on how the entity will settle or fulfil the liability. In paragraph 11, we summarise the likely outcome of that decision for different ways in which assets contribute to cash flows and which liabilities are settled or fulfilled. I think it's important to point out that the conceptual framework is intended just to include a discussion of the sort of factors that would be considered and the likely outcome for assets or liabilities of that type. It's not a sort of sausage factory where you feed in a particular way an asset will be realised or a liability will be settled and out pops your answer for measurement. It's designed to be more a series of factors that need to be considered and indications of where that might send you in terms of a particular measurement, rather than a definite this is the answer when you have this sort of situation. We also discuss situations where perhaps more than one measurement is relevant for a particular asset or liability, and say what the board might consider to do in those situations. There's two possible avenues they could explore. They could say include one particular measurement in the primary financial statement and the other measurement in the notes to the financial statements as an additional disclosure. Or the second approach that they could take is to use one particular measurement for the statement of financial position and a different measure for profit or loss, and base profit or loss on a different measure. The difference between those two measures would then end up in other comprehensive income, so in OCI. One thing to add about those two approaches of providing two different measures, of course, it has cost implications, and the board would need to consider quite carefully whether the benefits of providing two alternative measures are actually justified the costs associated with producing those measures. So with that, I'd like to address the questions below paragraph 12. Do you agree with the preliminary view that the selection of a measurement for an asset should depend on how it contributes to future cash flows, and for a liability will depend on how it's settled or fulfilled? And then did you have any comments on the discussion of situations where there is more than one relevant measure for a particular asset or liability?
Okay. Martin.
Okay, thanks. So I had a couple of questions and a comment. So my first kind of question is in relation to paragraph 10, which seems to focus really on the kind of cash flow and ability to value part of the objective. I'm just curious as to why stewardship wasn't really discussed in that piece at all, that it seemed to be the real focus was on future cash flows rather than past performance. Second point was, In the table in paragraph 11, when you're talking about selling being how the asset contributes to future cash flows, when you're talking in kind of in a trading environment, that very much makes sense. But if I think about inventories, then I tend would use, obviously, most of our inventories we would tend to want to sell. So whether the current market price is an appropriate valuation for inventories, probably doubt. And finally, on the point around mixed measurement, we weren't a big fan of the fair value to OCI for financial instruments, just on kind of complexity grounds, but certainly would want to maintain something which would allow actuarial gains and losses on pensions to be kept in OCI. So having current and fair value for liabilities and pension assets, while having something more amortised cost based, and it's not strictly amortised cost, but something current service cost, return on assets in the income statement, that is a good thing, we think.
Turkey, I think your second question first around inventories and the selling, and I think this goes back to my comment about this not being a sort of sausage factory, if you like. You know, you feed in an input and out pops your answer. We discuss inventories at length, I think, in the discussion paper, and highlight that inventories, that that many types of inventories are different from assets that you could just sell directly. So, for example, if you had a financial asset that's traded on a market, you can just sell that directly without very much effort or very much sort of, you know, you have a ready market there. When you're looking at something like inventories, you actually have to go through a whole selling process. To actually do it, you have to use those inventories in combination with other assets. So you're not getting direct cash flows from it in the same way as you would from a sort of standalone financial asset, for example. And that would suggest that perhaps a current market value would be less relevant than for the types of things where you can sell it directly. In addition, we do talk about the information that people use when analysing companies that are selling inventories, and say that often what is very useful to people is past history about margins, etc., which you would generally get from a sort of cost-based measure. And again, that sort of points us in the direction of saying for certainly for some types of inventory, and perhaps most inventories, a cost-based measure might be more relevant than actual sort of current market value or anything like that. Does that answer your question on the...
It does, and I think it that would that makes sense for many industries. Although for crude oil, I'm not sure how different that is from a financial asset in terms of its saleability.
And I think when you get to something like a commodity where there is a ready market, I think you have much more of a question mark whether the cost is the right answer, and whether perhaps some sort of current market value might provide more relevant information. But it will, again, it's going to depend upon the particular situations that you're looking at, and it's a judgment call. It's not an automatic yes or no to this.
Okay. Finished goods different from goods and services as well.
Yeah, you have to make a distinction, because, for example, the supermarket, what is the difference between financial assets and the goods they sell in a supermarket? That they receive it and they sell it immediately the same day. So I think the distinction between finished goods and trade goods versus raw materials, that would make sense in this.
And we've also got problems with our revenue recognition standard, haven't we, on some of this? When do you actually take up profit? Mike.
Thanks. I think the points are well made about inventory, and I think if we're using the principle that it has to be for selling, and I think this selling, using, collecting is a very attractive way forward. But I think we need to articulate a lot more clearly what we mean by selling, because the average person selling means it's the retail trade stock, so that's a problem. But I was also noticing in the table you've got at the foot of paragraph 11 that actually, charging for rights to use, we've ended up saying, well, it might be one or the other. So I wasn't sure how far it got us, and obviously we've decided, whatever else you say, or derivatives, we've obviously got some other principle that's driving you in derivatives. And I also thought about this in terms of investment property, and, well, we've got cost or fair value as a choice at the minute. How would that address that? And I wasn't sure whether there's necessarily enough here of what looks like, you know, an attractive idea to really be sure it's going to help you get answers.
Mary?
Just a comment to throw out, not so much in response to Mike's comment, but more generally, in this area, I think it's a second very important building block. Having said not a single measurement basis, we're saying here that it's really not strictly the attributes of the asset, and let me focus on the asset side, that drive its measurement, but that it's a combination of that it's how the asset is used, so that you might get the same asset being measured differently by two different entities depending upon how they are deploying it in their business. And I just wanted to flag that up and ask if anybody had any reactions, positive or negative, on that notion that's implicit here.
Sounds like deprival value.
Okay, those are words in my mouth. I will neither accept nor reject them. But just, I just really wanted to focus on that idea of saying it's not strictly an attribute of the asset, but how the asset is deployed that's implicit in this table. And whether or not you agree specifically with the likely measurement basis, do you agree with that, with that assumption behind the table?
Richard?
Yes, I think is the answer. And I was taking it from the asset, how it's likely to contribute to future cash flows, how it's likely to be, how a liability is likely to be settled, sounded like the right answer. And that is, in many ways, how I would have thought how entities are likely to deploy the asset or use the liability. So I would have thought that seemed quite helpful to me. Are you going to probably include these tables here, these sort of assets liabilities tables, with the measurement? Because already, there's a certain amount of I wonder whether that's the best approach. I wondered, for example, on the asset side, there's nothing here for future cash flow for a cash flow measure. For example, whereas holding for collection might sometimes be, I should have thought, measured helpfully by the expected cash flows. So I suppose perhaps I'm sure we need the concepts there, but whether you want to be quite so sort of strict about the boxes.
I
wonder whether in the discussion paper, fine, to give a sort of indication of where things are going, but I think ultimately in the framework itself, I wonder whether that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think the boxes are potentially misleading, and I sort of hesitated about putting them into the paper because they do suggest that you have a particular type of asset and that means you're going to have a particular type of asset, and I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it's going to be much more of a judgment call. I think what we'll have ultimately in the framework is a sort of indication of the factors that would drive you towards one particular measurement rather than anything that looks quite as definitive as the tables we've got in this paper.
But I think just to come back, I quite like the way it's set out in the document, the factors that were going to be considered, and I think that is important. Just taking up Tom's point about when preparers use this framework under IS 8, I think clearly there is, it's not, the answer is not black and white. It's not the sausage the sausage machine, and therefore I think the sort of factors people should think about, it's important to have those in the framework, because I think those are, preparers will need those factors where they're using the framework under IS 8. Good.
Yeah, I was just surprised not to see any reference here to sort of impairments or onerous obligations that would have effectively modified the cost basis. So I assume that's just taken for granted that's being... That's implied. I'd also written down inventory with lots of question marks next to it on the selling one. One question I also had was around, this looks like you're heading towards a sort of a management intent type
business model type
metric and the general support for that, except I think it's very important to also have the ability to hold. So I'm thinking here around loans and so forth, where at initiation you may well intend to hold it to maturity, but you can still be a going concern and recognise at a point in time that you are no longer able to hold it, even if that was your original intent, because the regulator is saying your ratios aren't working and you are therefore a forced seller. So things can, just saying, well, that was my original intent, is may not be enough.
Brenda.
I just wanted to support using this, the way that management intends to settle an obligation as a measurement basis. So if management has it in its own internal cash flow projections that a liability will be fulfilled in a particular way, then I think it's helpful to have that measure in the financial statements as well.
Roxanne.
Yeah, I was thinking whether it would be useful to also include in here the situation where there is a change in the intention the asset is used in particular, like from using it to selling it, because we have some specific requirements in standards like IFRS 5 or things like that. And I think it would be good to make a link, because sometimes it could be discussed.
Thank you. I have a specific question about paragraph 6. Also, chapter 6, paragraph 108. And that's about liabilities. That states liabilities arising from contractual obligations for services, performance obligations, have specified outcomes instead of stated terms. And then it comes a cost-based measurement starting with the proceeds received. And then I was thinking, how can you calculate the cost starting with your proceeds? Because that are not your costs. So I'm rather surprised about what I read there. Maybe I misinterpret.
Yeah, I think what we were trying to get to there was that it's sort of analogous to a cost-based measure for an asset, but instead of this is the price you paid for the asset on the liability side, it's this is the price you received in exchange for taking on the liability. So that's what we're trying to get to there.
But the price you receive for your service performance is your revenue normally. So then you'll say you have to deduct your profit and then you come to your cost.
No, we weren't trying to get to that. We weren't really trying to get to the original transaction price.
It's consistent with the revenue recognition project, isn't it? It's a transaction price. Transaction price on the contract is, we call it the cost of the contract in a sense. That's
yes.
The cost-based equivalent of revenue. So it wasn't intended to be the actual expenses. It's designed to measure transaction-based contract price.
Maybe that could be better clarified, to be honest.
Okay. Yes, Mike.
Yeah. First of all, just to Mary's question, yes, I'm quite happy with the point that you make there, Mary. And then if I could maybe just turn to the second set of questions that you were asking in this area, Rachel, which is multiple measures. And I think in terms of the first possibility of disclosure of the second measure, I think we need quite a high hurdle. Otherwise, it's an easy route to the accounts just becoming a really big, thick data pack of lots of different measurements. So I think there has to be, you know, a really high hurdle. You know, the temptation in the past has probably been it's a compromise around the board table. We can't agree on the measurement basis, so we'll buy off the dissenters by sticking it in the notes. I think we have to be really careful about that. And then your second one, in terms of whether or not to put it, we can have a different measure by using the P&L OCI split. I think you have to work out what the P&L OCI split is for in the first place, because otherwise it's another temptation to make another compromise about things people can't agree on, which is really where you are at the minute, where we are at the minute with the P&L and OCI.
Mm. Well, Finney's made the point earlier that sometimes the disclosures could be used to demonstrate stewardship. I'm not quite sure how, but the
Agree, and the issue though would be if you take your stewardship objective and the objective of disclosure, you could end up saying, well, what we really ought to do is disclose for every single asset and liability the alternative use basis, so that management is held accountable for the fact that they chose to do use A and not use B or C. And yeah, you could see the point of that, but that's the road to a lot of data. So fine idea, but I think they've got to be practical limits, really.
Okay, perhaps we should move on.
I'd probably like to take the questions, the last two questions together. Paragraph 13 just sets out some other considerations that that the ISB discussed when developing the discussion paper. And the first one, I think we've touched on already, the idea that when selecting a particular measure, the ISB should consider what information that measure would provide, not only in the statement of financial position, but also in profit or loss and other comprehensive income. That thinking about the balance sheet in isolation or thinking about profit or loss in isolation isn't necessarily going to provide the most relevant measure. We need to think about the effect it's going to have on both of them. We've also got the discussion that that goes throughout the conceptual framework, which is that we need to think about cost-benefit, and we need to decide whether the benefits associated with a particular measure justify the costs associated with that measure. The final question that I'd like to wrap up on with this is whether you had any other comments on the measurement section in general, in addition to those two additional points. So with that, I'd like to put it open.
Regarding the cost benefit, I was wondering, when I read the document, then at specific places it's made reference to the cost benefit analysis, and I was wondering why this is done, because cost benefit should be always there. So and now it might give the impression that in specific areas the cost-benefit analysis is more important than in other areas, and I don't think that is correct. So maybe it's better to start at the beginning of the conceptual framework, elaborating about the cost-benefit analysis, and leave it there.
Any other general points or answers to Richard?
Yeah, just to reinforce the cost benefit thing. There's also particularly when you're on these multiple measures in one place and another. I mean, there is complexity and understandability that can be impaired, can be a cost or an issue when we've got multiple measures in different parts of the accounts. I just wondered whether you felt the conceptual framework was just going to say enough about the different measures. We've talked about the selection of the measures, and then we started to mention that there might be more than one way of measuring some of these objectives, and that the sort of three boxes in each of those boxes might lurk more than one possibility. And I wondered whether you wanted to say a bit more about, whether you should be saying a bit more about, you know, the current market prices, other current value measures. And you do say some things about what the cash flow measure should have in it. And I just wondered whether we're saying something about that, but not very much about current market prices.
I'd be interested in views on that, because it's difficult for us to strike the right balance in terms of getting enough sort of detail to make things understandable, but recognizing that it's a conceptual framework and we don't want to go into too much sort of standards level type detail. Would you people have liked to have seen more discussion around sort of cost-based measures and the current market prices than we perhaps have there? And do you think the conceptual framework is the right place for that sort of discussion?
Martin.
Yeah, I think it might be helpful to clarify what exactly is meant by cost-based. One of the things I've written down when I was reading this was around, well, what about, I'm trying to reconcile it back to existing standards, so forgive me if I'm not meant to do that. But trying to think about how it applies to deferred tax assets and liabilities, which I guess on one hand, it's the difference between two numbers which are probably cost-based. So does that make it cost-based? And if so, does deferred tax fall under that? And if not, it doesn't seem to be in any of the other two. So does that then mean we have to think about whether revising the deferred tax standard, and if so, is that a good idea? Clarifying what exactly you mean by cost, and can it be the difference between two costs or something else?
The ASB, the UK ASB, when I was there, had a go at the tax project and really had a lot of trouble coming up with an answer, conceptual or otherwise. It's still a very difficult subject.
Well, I think I did say I feel you should add a bit. Well, the implication of my question was I think you should add a bit more.
Okay, Phineas.
Yeah, just finally, just to say, we support the measurement objective, and I think we'll get onto this later, but I think if you're going to include the stewardship function within the measurement objective, it seems only right that it should be within the primary objective. Financial reporting.
As we said before, that quote right at the beginning is straight out of chapter one. So we haven't written new things for the measurement chapter. So I mean,
yeah, but if you, I mean, at the moment we're saying stewardship is something that should be in the notes of the accounts. I suppose I'm saying.
Well, where's say that?
You, I mean, just for example, on page 12 of the discussion paper, you've got a presentation disclosure. You say the objective of is all the following, and then decision usefulness. But then you say the objective of the notes is to supplement the primary financial statements, and then you go on to describe the stewardship function, which is how efficiently and effectively the entity's management and governing board have discharged their responsibilities. So in other words, it's something which is reserved for the notes.
No, I think if you look at chapter one, of the existing conceptual framework, that wording about how efficiently and effectively management has used its resources is taken straight out of chapter one. So it's there as part of the overall objective of financial reporting that you need to have information in order to be able to assess stewardship. And what we've done in places in the discussion paper is we've pulled out that wording and highlighted it. We've highlighted it in the measurement section. We've highlighted it in the presentation and disclosure section when putting out the objective of disclosure and presentation, but that's not to suggest that it's limited to those areas. It's pervasive. It goes throughout the financial statements, and when developing the entire financial statements, you need to assess whether you're meeting that objective of providing information that's useful for stewardship effectively, to use a shorthand.
That's good to hear, but I think then it's strange that in presentation and disclosure that distinction is made. Why have you separated that out in terms of stewardship? I mean, you've separated out the primary objective of financial statements, and then you've referred to stewardship as something for the notes. I just think that's a bit strange given what you've just said.
If you look at paragraph 7.18, where it talks about what the objective of the primary financial statements are, you'll see that in paragraph C, it's also got how efficiently, effectively the entity's management have discharged their responsibilities. So if you take the primary financial statements and the notes together, it has that same.
All right.
Sorry. Giving stewardship and information to make decisions the same prominence in various parts of this paper, does that mean that the objective of financial statements will be amended? Because there we are talking about the making decisions, and then it is said that stewardship decisions is included. So that's another prominence as it now has in various parts of this discussion paper.
Well, I don't think we've changed it, because if I understand it correctly, we've actually just taken the quotes out of the first chapter when we've gone through the document. So it's exactly the same.
But when I read OB2, we are talking about making decisions about providing resources to the entity.
Right, but OB4 then goes on to talk about what that means in more detail. There's a chain down through OB2, OB3, OB4, which builds on what's OB2. And OB4 is where you get the discussion of the efficiency and effectiveness of the use of the resources. So we wanted to make sure that wasn't just sort of left stranded in Chapter 1, but that it is picked up in the rest of the document.
Technically, you will be right. I think it will be perceived not that way by everybody, to be honest.
Why not?
Because there are a lot of people thinking that in the way it's now structured in the framework, that stewardship is at a lower level than giving information for making decisions.
But not if you read the words.
it is how it is perceived. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I think I agree with Tom and with Phineas that there does seem to be a bit of a contradiction in 6.35a. I recognise it talks equally about stewardship and kind of future cash flows. But then it goes on in D to say, well, for an asset, we're going to focus on future cash flows, and that's the way that's the way you should assess how you measure an asset. And then doesn't talk anything about stewardship at all in that piece. I think it's the background and the lead-in recognises the balance between stewardship and assessing future cash flows. But then when you get down to how do you select a basis for measurement, you settle on future cash flows as being the key one. So I guess you can't measure something using two different bases. It's one or the other.
I don't know if it's helpful to go back and look in how OB4 sets it out. For those who have a copy of the discussion paper, it's reprinted in the back on 195, and it makes the link back to say, to assess an entity's prospects for future net cash inflows, you know, having said a couple paragraphs before that's the objective. The entity's prospects for future net cash inflows, investors, lenders, and other creditors need information about the resources of the entity, claims against the entity, and how efficiently and effectively management and governing board have discharged their responsibilities. So I think that's right there. It's saying, okay, when we say cash inflows, it includes that how well you've used them, not just the quantum of them. So I think it's OB4 that right up front tries to make that explanation that it's both quantitative and qualitative in terms of cash flows.
We'll need to look at that. We do need to move on, I think. We've taken an hour on this, so that's good. Thank you.
Sorry, can I just ask Martin something? I don't want to put you on the spot today, but I was thinking through what you were saying. I'm wondering what we might have put in to build in that extra objective and not instantly thinking of anything. And so I'm not going to ask you to try and instantly think of anything on the spot either. But if you are contributing to a comment letter and you think we should put something there on that point you just made, it would be helpful if you could not just say we think you ought to explain how you satisfy the stewardship function or something along those lines, but actually give us a hint about how to do it as well.
Or maybe if you've decided that actually future cash flows and making it easier for investors to do valuations that is the more important thing, that you say that and you recognise that there are two contradictory measurement bases, and we've gone with this one rather than the other one. That would also be valid.
But I don't think that's the case at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's the case either, which is why I think if you suggest that we ought to make a change, that would be quite helpful to have some sort of pointers about how to do it.
Okay.
I think the point is, I think our intention's the same as what you're saying, and I think Chapter 1 does it quite well at the moment, so there's no need to change Chapter 1, but we've just got to make sure we reflect it properly as we go through it. We've tried to do that by using the same words as Chapter 1, but then when you go on with the explanations, you can see that sometimes people will read it in a different way.